All right, I'm going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order since it is 9:45. We do not yet have a quorum, but we can start taking testimony and so forth. The members will be here, I assume, shortly. The first bill on the agenda is House File 136, Representative Stevenson. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, I will not move your bill yet, but I will shortly. But if you could present your bill, please. We do have a pretty full agenda, so I'm going to ask testifiers also to be limited to 2 or 3 minutes generally. Welcome. If you could please describe your bill, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It is hard to think of a more significant consumer protection issue in Minnesota today than the need for net neutrality. Given the amazing power of the Internet, how it's come to impact literally every corner of our lives, it's absolutely essential that every Minnesotan have access to a fair and open Internet. Today, Internet service providers have the power to decide, free from any limitation, what we see when we open our browsers. Never before in our state's history has any private company had such incredible power to shape the public's understanding of the world around them. Without net neutrality, Internet service providers have the unchecked power to pick winners and losers in our economy, in our culture, and in our very democracy. They can speed up your access to websites that feature products they favor. They can block access or simply slow down to the point that it effectively blocks your access to services they dislike. Huge established market players like Facebook can enter into agreements with Internet service providers that ensure that their websites reach consumers at the highest speeds available, while startups and small businesses lacking the money and power to negotiate are left in the slow lane. Internet service providers will tell you that they have no interest in doing any of this. Indeed, many say they support net neutrality, but just want one standard across the entire country. But these same companies have invested huge amounts of resources in fighting net neutrality in the Congress, at the Federal Communications Commission, and in every state capital where it's been considered. Actions speak louder than words, and the huge investments that these companies have made in fighting net neutrality at every turn speak for themselves. The bill before you contains essentially two provisions. First, it enacts net neutrality in our state statutes and makes it illegal for Internet service providers to engage in anti-competitive, anti-free market, and anti-consumer behavior. The second provision prohibits the state from doing business with any service provider that doesn't agree to act in accordance with net neutrality principles. The idea that huge Internet service providers can make decisions behind closed doors and without limitation about what information the American people have access to is frightening. All Minnesotans deserve to be able to access the Internet on their own terms, not those dictated by private corporations. And, Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment, but I understand we'll have to wait until...
That is very timely, Representative Stevenson. We do now have a quorum, so I will officially call this meeting to order. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of the February 28th meeting of Government Operations?
So moved.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Moved approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the minutes are adopted. So I will move that House File 136 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. So the bill is now before us, and you do have, and I understand there's an A7 author's amendment.
That's
this
correct.
Would put the bill in the shape you like it, Representative Stevenson?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none.
Mr. Chair, could you explain it?
Sure. Could you please explain the amendment, Representative Stevenson?
Yes, I'm happy to explain the amendment. The bill was heard previously in the Commerce Committee, and we had some discussions with people in industry, in the telecommunications industry, about some changes we could make that would make the bill more workable for them, and was happy to make those changes. First, it changes. There had been some discussion in the bill prior to possibility of perjury consequences for corporations that violated the terms of their agreement with the state if they were contracting with the state. That made some providers nervous, in particular that individuals who worked for companies, service providers, might have criminal liability individually, which was not the intent of the bill. And so we have changed that to make clear that it's a civil penalty and actually removed a reference to perjury from the bill. In addition, there was concern expressed in the Commerce Committee about an issue that it's not really retransmission, but has been called retransmission. Essentially, there are some edge providers right now that are experimenting with a new business model where They are trying to charge internet service providers fees to so that their customers, the end users, can have access to the content. And we wanted to make clear that internet service providers should be able to block access to those websites when they, the internet service providers, are the ones being asked to pay a fee, not the consumer. So we clarified that language as well. So it's just a few small fixes designed to try and make the bill a little bit more workable for industry.
Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, there have been concerns raised about this bill and the expansion of broadband, that in effect, if this bill becomes law, we are going to have even greater difficulty expanding broadband. So does this amendment address all of the concerns that have been raised with the expansion of broadband?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, it addresses almost all. There's one fundamental disagreement. I understand, I want to say almost all because I understand that some of the telecom providers who participate in the broadband program are still opposed to the bill. They're opposed to it, my understanding is, and you'll probably hear from them in a minute, because they think there should be a federal standard and not a state standard. But it does address the specific comments. I do not believe this bill should have have any problem with expansion of rural broadband. And that's very much my intent to not interfere with that program. In fact, I have a meeting with the head of the Office for Rural Broadband tomorrow, and you have my absolute commitment, as I did with this amendment, that I will work to make sure that there's no interference with that program.
Representative Pawlowski.
So, Mr. Chair, is it the intent of the chair, if this bill doesn't work, we're still going to pass it today to Ways and Means?
Representative Pawlowski, I don't know that I'd agree with the assessment that it doesn't work. We will see what the testimony says and decide what to do.
Oh, Mr. Chair, now we're sort of at loggerheads because we have one committee who is trying to expand broadband in the House, and it would appear we have another committee with a bill that may limit broadband expansion in the House. So I hope we resolve those two differences.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Pawlowski. Representative Quam, to the amendment.
Yes, to the amendment. Does that impact the fiscal note?
This is not a fiscal committee, but Representative Stevenson, if you're able to answer that.
I am able to answer that, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam. It should not impact the fiscal note. The fiscal note was requested and is still in progress. The bill is going to go to at least two finance committees after this.
Okay. Thank you. So we are on the amendment still. Is there any further discussion? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape you like it. Representative Stevenson?
I do have one additional testifier before any public testimony, Mr. Chair. It's John Gordon from the American Civil Liberties Union, who's seated to my right here.
Sure, that would be fine. And I did want to mention before Mr. Gordon proceeds, I did just ask staff which provisions of this bill are within the jurisdiction of government operations. Generally, Section 1 regulates the ability of state agencies and local governments to enter contracts. That would generally be the provision within the purview of the Government Operations Committee. So to the extent we can keep conversation limited to that, that would be helpful. Mr. Gordon, if you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'm John Gordon. I'm the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. I'm very grateful to be here this morning, grateful for the invitation from Representative Stevenson and to the chair and to the committee for the opportunity to support House File 136 and to support our great state in joining the more than two dozen other states that are already working to protect net neutrality in the face of federal gridlock and inaction on this important issue, which affects all of us in the way that we engage in our civic discourse and the way that we all of us participate in the economic life of this country. I'll be very brief this morning, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here and take a little bit of your time. Information and communication are the lifeblood of democracy. When they are permitted to flow freely, our democracy grows and strengthens. When they are blocked or inhibited, democracy slowly dies. The Federal Communications Commission's December 2017 decision to grant Internet Service Providers, that is ISPs, the ability to decide what online content is permitted to travel in the information superhighway's high occupancy vehicle lane, and what information is relegated to the slow lane, and what information is prohibited from getting onto the highway at all, presents a significant threat to the freedom of all Americans and certainly to the people of Minnesota. Arguments by the FCC and by some internet service providers that the end of net neutrality would foster greater internet freedom and innovation simply don't work. The only thing that eliminating net neutrality did when they tried to do it at the federal level was to allow ISPs to engage in content-based discrimination. And there are arguments, there are instances of that happening all over the country, and those that communication based on political views and business interests of the ISPs get throttled or encouraged depending on what the ISP wants to accomplish. None of us want that to happen. An overwhelming number of American states and of the American people are united in their view that the FCC's elimination of net neutrality is unacceptable. More than two dozen other states, have introduced net neutrality legislation, and four of those state legislatures have already passed their bills. That is Washington, Vermont, Oregon, and California. So Minnesota is certainly not alone in paying attention to this issue. In addition, the governors of Montana, New York, New Jersey, Hawaii, Rhode Island, and Vermont, those governors in those states have already issued executive orders to try to preserve net neutrality. The support for this among the American people is overwhelming, and it is bipartisan. According to a December 2017 poll by the University of Maryland, 83% of Americans favored preserving net neutrality rules that the FCC abandoned. That includes 75% of Republicans, 89% of Democrats, and 86% of Independents. So it's very much of a bipartisan issue, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. If you could wrap up your testimony,
please. I will. Without net neutrality, we are going to lose the ability to use the Internet for important public matters such as this hearing and including the preparation that many of us have done for this hearing. The idea that there should be a federal rule is a great idea, but the ISPs have blocked it at the federal level, and that's why we are here. If anyone is going to pick up the banner of net neutrality and move it forward in 2019, Mr. Chair, it is going to be the states, not the federal government, and I urge the members of this committee to vote for House File 136.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. Representative Quam, did you have a question for this testifier specifically? Okay. So I have four people on the list who've signed up: Jim Beatty, Paul Wirtz, Justin Ford, and John Dukic. Just so I could see a show of hands, is there anybody else who wants, so I could try to gauge the time this will take? Could I see a show of hands of anyone else who would like to speak on this issue? Okay, I don't see any. So I will call Jim Beatty to the testifying table, and Paul Wirtz, if you could get ready, that would be great. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Freiberg, members of the committee, my name is Jim Beatty, and I am General Counsel and Director of Government Relations for BevCom, a rural telecommunications provider of telephone, cable, TV, and broadband services in several communities in southern Minnesota, including New Prague, Pine Island, and Orinoco. I am here today to testify on behalf of my company as well as the other members of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, and I thank you for the opportunity to do so. First of all, I would like to my testimony originally was going to discuss the perjury provisions of this bill, but I would like to thank Representative Stevenson for working with our industry in removing those perjury provisions from this bill, and it's much appreciated. First of all, I want to point out that BevCom and other members of the MTA have long been proponents of the principles of net neutrality. Let me be clear, we do not block, we do not throttle, or engage in paid prioritization of lawful internet traffic. So if we don't do these things, why do we have concerns with this bill? Well, Representative Stevenson pointed out that he had not heard any specific concerns about how this may affect the broadband grant program in particular. But there is a provision in this bill which would allow the state or any state agency to unilaterally request a return of all governmental contract monies paid and all revenues earned from a broadband grant application and those that have been placed into the ground. So I do believe that that would have a definite hindrance in the broadband grant program in the future. It would make companies like us look really hard at whether or not we wanted to make that investment, with the risk that the Department of Commerce or any other state agency would determine that we had made a net neutrality violation. Finally, and I'll be very brief again, I know your time is limited, this bill still gives the Minnesota Department of Commerce jurisdiction over an information service, jurisdiction that has been successfully challenged in federal court twice. So, and it will likely be challenged again if this bill passes. So I caution this committee to be wary of passing legislation that would likely be challenged in court, and Minnesota is 0-2 in those court challenges to date. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Beatty. The next on the list I have is Paul Wirtz. Welcome
Thank
to
you,
the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Wirtz. I'm the state president for AT&T Minnesota. I represent more than 1,500 employees around the state of Minnesota, providing world-class wireless coverage. AT&T Minnesota invests more than $100 million a year in Minnesota's economy, and we've invested more than $1 billion since 2010. In 2018 alone, we invested over or made over 1,300 network investments in communities across Minnesota, adding new cell sites, expanding LTE network capacity, and deploying small cells. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to the committee members on this very important topic. Let me be open by saying that AT&T is committed to an open internet. We do not block websites, we do not censor online content, and we do not throttle, discriminate, or degrade internet traffic, period. We have publicly committed to these principles for over 10 years now, and we will continue to abide by them in order to provide our customers with the open internet experience that they have come to expect. These commitments are published on our website. They were reiterated by our Chairman Randall Stephenson in an open letter last year, and their commitments are enforced by the Minnesota Attorney General, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Federal Communications Commission. We oppose House File 1136 because we believe Congress, not the states, ought to end the debate over internet regulations once and for all, for writing new laws that govern the internet and protect consumers. Congressional action is needed to establish an internet bill of rights that applies to all internet companies and guarantees neutrality, transparency, openness, non-discrimination, and privacy protection for all internet users. Federal legislation would not only ensure consumer rights are protected, but would provide a consistent rules of the road for all internet companies across all websites, content, devices, and applications. There is no doubt the internet has changed all of our lives and grown beyond what anyone could have ever imagined. The internet has been a major driver not only for economic growth, but advancements in everything from education to healthcare to entertainment. And I think we need to be mindful of the fact that since 1996, the entire telecommunication internet providers have invested $1.5 trillion in infrastructure over a 20-year period. Because our internet is so important to everyone across our country, we need a single national policy. It's vital that Congress takes action, not the states, on federal legislation that protects the open internet for all users and encourages continued investment for the next generation and internet innovation to come. I'd like to cite a couple of things. I know there's discussion about investment and usage. The Blandin Foundation has a Blandin blog that in January they talked about, and this is citing Open Vault. Despite the cries that, you know, there's going to be the end of the internet and the end of free speech, actually household internet usage is going up. And they cite this from Open Vault, 268.7 gigabytes of data in 2018, up from 201.6 gigabytes for 2017. That's from Open Vault, a provider of data consumption and analytics software. The median usage is also up. The increase in average consumption was 33.3%, and the increase in median consumption was 40%. So despite the fact that this rule was rescinded by the FCC, consumption and data usage continues to go up along multiple providers, along multiple devices. We've talked about the impediment to the broadband grant program. I served on Governor Dayton's broadband task force I think I still have about another month left in that term. And over a five-year period that I served on that, I can tell you that the issue of net neutrality and doing something with that so that we could promote broadband, increased usage of broadband, or increased investment in broadband was never raised. This is the 2018 report. There's no recommendation on net neutrality. And I can tell you there were folks, and there are folks that sit on that task force, not just providers, Communication Workers of America, others who have a distinctly different viewpoint on the debate over net neutrality, and that was not a policy recommendation that was raised in any of these reports over the last 5 years.
You could wrap up your testimony, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I'll be ready for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Woods. Next on the list, I have Justin Ford. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Justin Forty, and I am the Senior Director of Government Relations for Mid-Continent Communications, or MIDCO. MIDCO is an internet and networking provider in the upper Midwest. In fact, we started in 1931 in the movie theater business in Minneapolis, progressed into television, cable, and now the largest portion of our business is the internet and broadband. We are also members of the Minnesota Cable Association, and we have made it our mission to ensure that the people of rural Minnesota, the communities that we serve, are at the leading edge of technology. MIDCO is focused on expanding service to unserved communities who do not have access to our network. We offer a competitive advantage and alternative in many areas, providing a choice for consumers. There are challenges and high costs associated with building wired infrastructure in our rural communities due to difficult terrain or sparse population. For those communities, we use our MIDCO edge-out strategy and extend connectivity from our wired line using fixed wireless technology. MIDCO has supported the state in the hard work of ensuring all Minnesotans have access to broadband services and greatly appreciates the partnership of state lawmakers in this effort with the Minnesota Border-to-Border Broadband Grant Program. In 2017, we extended our network to Little Fork, Canby, Porter, Totten, Mineota, and Ghent, six small communities in Minnesota by partnering with the state using broadband grant funds. In 2018, we received broadband grants from the state to build a portion of rural Annandale and to Wanamingo. And more recently, the Federal Communications Commission provisionally awarded MIDCO over $27 million to extend our network to over 100,000 more homes in rural Minnesota. Let me be clear. MIDCO, like all Minnesota cable companies, supports and strictly adheres to the principles of net neutrality. We do not block, throttle, or interfere with customer access to the Internet. These principles are enshrined in our commitment to our customers and the people of Minnesota. They are also binding and enforceable by the Federal Trade Commission. This legislation would have negative consequences for our broadband investment in Minnesota. With this bill, we would be significantly concerned about applying for future state or federal broadband grant funds. If this ambiguously worded bill were to become law and we were accused of violating it, we would be faced with significant financial penalties. We are extremely diligent in tracking with state and federal laws, but a minor infraction and an erroneous decision by a state agency ill-equipped to understand or investigate reasonable network management practices could be devastating for our small Minnesota company. Additionally, MIDCO operates a network that crosses multiple state borders. We operate in Fargo and Moorhead, East Grand Forks and Grand Forks, crossing over into the Dakotas, down through Iowa, Wisconsin, and Kansas. What is deemed as reasonable network management in one state could be viewed entirely different in another. This is why a unified national approach is the best path to ensure that consistent net neutrality principles. Congress has the power to enshrine these into federal law. Again, Minnesota has been a leader and an innovator and a partner with MIDCO when it comes to deploying broadband and encouraging investment in the technology sector. We urge you to reject the state approach to net neutrality and instead focus on public policy that encourages investment, competition, and innovation. Thank you for the committee's time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Forty. Next up, I have John Dukic. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Dukic, and I'm with the Minnesota High Tech Association. We are a trade association that represents 300 science and technology companies across the state. The IT sector accounts for 8.6% of Minnesota's economy and employs 250,000 people, paying an average wage of nearly $98,000, which is about 75% more than the state's private sector wage. The internet is the backbone to Minnesota's technology sector and a conduit to the global economy. That's why we firmly believe that any regulation of the internet should occur at the federal level. A key component to fostering a vibrant technology ecosystem is a clear, consistent set of rules governing the conduct of businesses, governmental entities, and citizens, and this holds for the Internet as well. There's been too much inconsistency in the rules and policies governing the Internet, varying with the changes in leadership at the Federal Communications Commission. Enacting state-based laws and regulations governing the Internet only exacerbates this inconsistency, creating a patchwork of laws and regulations across the state for what is ultimately an interstate and global issue. Inconsistencies in the regulatory framework of the Internet hinders the deployment of advanced communications technologies and applications that rely on those technologies. As states like Minnesota work to expand broadband through public-private partnerships, we must make sure that we optimize the return on those investments while encouraging the development of and deployment of novel technologies. While there are a number of ways to do this, providing regulatory certainty to broadband providers is chief among them, and only an act of Congress can provide this certainty. If legislation like House File 136 becomes law, we're concerned about the negative impact on Minnesota's technology ecosystem. If broadband providers pull back on their investment, it will have a negative impact not only on them, but on the businesses that rely on broadband to reach new markets and customers, and on those businesses that develop technologies that require an internet connection, like connected vehicles, telemedicine, and health IT. This bill seems to add more uncertainty for broadband providers. For example, there are a number of terms in the bill that are introduced but not defined. This includes terms like favor on line 2.6. For example, what does it mean to directly or indirectly favor some traffic over other traffic? Other terms include those on line 2.7, such as impair, impede, and degrade. And additionally, on line 2.18, it's not clear what constitutes a reasonable network management. It's not clear how these terms should be defined, but their definitions impact how the legislation is implemented. Furthermore, there's no guarantee that whatever definitions are adopted here will be adopted by other states. This uncertainty and possible inconsistency or lack of uniformity in various definitions between states only exacerbates the patchwork nature of this type of state-based legislation. The issues around internet policy and regulation is much broader than any one state and should be addressed at the federal level. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Dukic. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, not seeing any. Representative Stevenson, I just had a... The whole issue of broadband is a little outside of this committee's jurisdiction. The main issue before us is the contract language. I assume the issue of broadband was discussed in Commerce. Did you have any clarifying points on that?
It was discussed. Mr. Chair, yes, it was discussed in Commerce, and as I indicated, having received a number of pieces of feedback from industry in that area, I worked to develop the author's amendment that the committee adopted at the beginning of the session to address some of those concerns. I did neglect to point out one other thing that is pretty important on the broadband section, and I would direct the committee's attention to subdivision 4 of section 1. This is line 3.5 on the bill, which contains an exception that says that the whole section 1 does not apply to a broadband internet access service in a geographic location where broadband internet access service is only available from a single internet service provider, which of course really does describe the broadband grant program and the purpose of the broadband grant program. So that should also provide some comfort, and as I mentioned before, I am meeting with the head of the broadband grant office actually tomorrow, and it's certainly not the intent of this bill to impede that program at all.
Okay. Representative Quam, you have been on the list to speak.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and this is for the author, and I must commend the author. I like the intent of preventing powerful entities from controlling, filtering, content, blocking sites, but when that comes to mind, it actually seems to be some of those that you mentioned, Facebook, Google, YouTube, etc. So, I commend the intent. However, when the states created and empowered the federal government, it enumerated certain things. And one of the things that empowered the federal government was interstate commerce. And I don't see any way that the topic of this bill doesn't cause, because that's what it is. It's information and other things flowing across commerce across state boundaries. So how can the state actually try and influence contracts and therefore impede or control interstate commerce. I'm just trying to understand the author's defense of,
thank you,
of that point.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Klum. I did hear the word contracts in there. So when I heard the word commerce, I thought hopefully that was addressed in the Commerce Committee. But since you did raise the word contracts, Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Klum. Yes, so I think even if you have a very strict interpretation of the Commerce Clause, you believe that the state has the power to enter into contracts to pick which Internet service provider it purchases Internet from, you know, on whatever grounds it wants to. And so Section 1, the section that this committee is looking at today, basically instructs the state to only purchase Internet from ISPs that promise to be net neutral. And I don't think that there's a Commerce Clause, that you could really make a Commerce Clause argument as to that. As to Section 2, which I understand the committee has not had jurisdiction over, there is some dispute about whether the Commerce Clause has jurisdiction there. And I do believe that this is a constitutional provision and that it isn't barred by the Commerce Clause. And I'd be happy to talk to you about that outside of the hearing since the committee isn't addressing that issue today.
Okay. Representative Klum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, for the committee members, the broad interpretation by the U.S. Supreme Court into the federal government's control over commerce even has been determined down to a farmer growing what he wanted for a crop to eat himself. In other words, that was commerce with himself, not even across state lines. And he was found in breach of the federal government's control. So us making a contract with an entity, and that contract involves commerce, I think it would be naive for us to feel that this didn't cause issue, especially with the plethora of court cases around this and the you know, the impact. So I think we need to be very careful on how we try to force things into a contract that are constraints beyond the state's domain, and that's my big concern.
Thank you, Representative Klum. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author. A lot of testifiers seem to have concern about handling this on a state level. What would be your response to the concern by companies such as Midco and others that are operating the same network within multiple states, as far as if they do basic network management, that the North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin Department of Commerce seem all good with, but then the Minnesota Department of Commerce seems to have a challenge with. Aren't we setting up these companies try to read tea leaves and not providing much guidance for them as they try to manage their networks? What would a response to that be?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, it's a fair concern, and there should be a federal standard. I would love for the federal government to pass a federal net neutrality bill, which they have failed to do so for many years, and I don't expect for them to do this year. My response would be that many states, as Mr. Gordon testified, many states have enacted these net neutrality principles, and so the concern about whether we're going to have a patchwork of internet regulations, that patchwork already exists. The question is, are we going to make sure that Minnesotans are protected the same way that Californians are and people who live in Washington State and many other states around the country, or are we going to leave Minnesotans unprotected? We can do nothing in this committee, in this legislature, to ensure that there's a uniform standard, because there already is a patchwork.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stevenson, you mentioned if Minnesotans are going to be protected as Californians already are, but as I understand, the California law has actually not gone into effect and is being held for enactment due to multiple federal litigations. Is that correct?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, it is true that the California law's enactment date has been stayed. There's a challenge underway in the D.C. Circuit to the Federal Communications Commission's decisions to repeal the Obama-era net neutrality rules, and California has agreed to stay implementation of their law until that litigation is concluded. Basically, if the lawsuit's successful in D.C. Circuit, we'll have a federal net neutrality standard. So they want to wait and see if that happens. We delayed our enactment date, actually, on the Commerce Committee for a similar reason. So this is the enactment date in the bill now. It had been day after enactment. Now it's August 1st to allow for the litigation in the D.C. Circuit to conclude.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the concerns being raised in kind of the interpretation of the California bill, and we have some language in here in lines 3.23 to 3.29 in your bill, are that some of how this is could be interpreted by the Department of Commerce may lead to a ruling that differences in the implementation of internet allocation or data plans could seem unfair to consumers. And so one of the big concerns coming out of the California law is that if enacted, the California bill would ban unlimited data plans because it could be inequitable to other consumers. Representative Stevenson, would your bill ban Minnesotans from having an unlimited data plan in the state of Minnesota, as others have alleged?
We're getting a little afield, Representative Zerwas, of the contracting language that's in the jurisdiction, but I will allow Representative Stevenson to provide a brief answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, no.
That was pretty brief, Representative Stevenson. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Zerwas.
I think when you look at the Internet Conduct Rule and how it's being interpreted as a part of the California language and the mirrored language that you have in your bill, I think it's quite obvious that what you would do by making sure that every consumer, that every plan is offered to every consumer at every equity throughout, would in fact inhibit a provider's ability to have HBO unlimited data plans on their phones or Netflix unlimited data plans offered through their ISPs. And I think that's something that Minnesotans wouldn't be very supportive of and wouldn't be favorable for. Mr. Chair, we'd like a roll call vote on this bill because we think the moves to regulate and prevent Minnesotans from utilizing unlimited data plans would be harmful to our economy, harmful to internet access for people of different socioeconomic statuses. And one final question. You talked about the clause you have in the bill to exempt individuals from the broadband program if they're the sole internet provider. To the author of the bill, how does that interact with wireless providers of internet services? Because there are often areas within the state of Minnesota that there's a sole broadband provider of fiber in the ground, but can still get internet service provider via their cell phones.
Okay. Roll call's been requested. Brief answer. Again, we're getting a little field from...
I think this deals directly with the broadband contracting portion through the broadband grant program, Mr. Chair. This is directly in the strike zone.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, number one, I think if you look at the definition of what broadband is in here and the fact that the exemption applies to broadband, it doesn't include, for example, satellite internet providers, which Representative Garofalo was quick to note in the Commerce Committee, allows anyone to have access to internet anywhere in the state and kind of gets at what you're talking about. So I think that the definition of broadband is tailored enough to mitigate that concern. Just very briefly, I want to note that when you talk about unlimited data plans, your question to me first was unlimited plans generally, and then when you said that you thought it did prevent, you were talking about unlimited data plans as to HBO or Netflix. And that's a very different beast where a company is negotiating and saying, we'll give you unlimited access to Netflix, but you're going to have to pay more for HBO. That does fall into net neutrality. So when I understood your question about unlimited data plans, I thought you were talking about net neutral data plans, not content-specific data plans. And I actually think Minnesotans would have a big problem with having to pay more to have access to HBO, letting their ISP decide which media producer they can access and which one they have to pay more for.
representatives there was to the contracting language?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up question for the bill author. Is the bill we're about to vote for, would your language ban cell phone providers from providing free Netflix subscriptions or other things to their customers? Because I think that's something that would be... I watch a lot of Netflix, Representative Stevenson. I really love the classics. And so would your bill, if enacted, ban a provider from incenting or offering for free or for discounted rate premium content or streaming services?
Representative Stevenson.
Again, the answer to your question, the way you just asked it, is no. What the bill does is it requires internet service providers to be neutral as to the source of the content and not pick winners and losers.
Okay. Representative Zerwas, to the contracting language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're being very generous today.
Yes, I am.
to the bill author, so what would be an example of something that's occurring today that your bill would ban as far as picking winners and losers for providing content to their customers?
Representative Stevenson, then I'm going to move on to the next member.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I had understood from speaking with some industry members that there are some contracting arrangements going on right now where contractors are agreeing, or internet service providers are agreeing with specific content providers that they will carry their content on a net-neutral basis. They won't block or throttle, right? Those kind of one-off agreements would be an example of things that would be prohibited under this. They have to do the same thing for everybody. Can't pick winners or losers.
Okay. I mentioned this at the outset of the hearing, but my intention is to hopefully get through the agenda. We do have this committee room longer up until about 12:45. If necessary, we will reconvene this evening. I can't promise exactly what time that will be at. It's potentially as late as 9 p.m. because the several members are on the Pension Commission, which meets from 5 to 7. Some members are on the Transportation Committee, which meets at 7. So members are aware of that. Representative Tice is next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the bill author, Representative Stevenson, I heard this in Commerce, and I am just convinced that we're trying to fix something that isn't broken. I have heard nothing. I mean, we heard a testifier say this is such an important issue to our folks. I've heard nothing. None of the companies in my area have expressed any issue with it, and I just firmly believe this is a federal issue. We should not be doing this. We're causing problems just trying to fix what's not broken, and it really, I have no idea how you're going to enforce. If somebody says there's a problem, how are you going to enforce it? Is somebody going to go from spot to spot to spot to spot trying to figure out what's broken? If it's throttling, if it's this, if it's that, what if it's just poor Wi-Fi? And that's the problem. I mean, I'm seeing that it could have a huge price tag, and quite frankly, I don't think Minnesota at this time can afford a huge price tag in doing something that I'm not hearing is a problem. I'm really not. It is just not on anybody's... It's just not there. It's crickets. So I just have a lot of concerns. I don't feel like we're fixing anything. I think we're looking to try to overregulate something that should be on the federal level and not on the state level. And I feel like we're kind of wasting time. I'm not really sure that this will become law. And we have a lot of other things on our agenda. But I really think this is going to be something that's going to cost Minnesotans. And they might not even care or notice or have an issue. So I just wanted to let you know my concerns after hearing this in Commerce and now here. And I will be voting no. I don't think it's a good idea for Minnesota to do this.
Thank you for expressing your concerns, Representative Tice. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, we've heard about the subjectivity and kind of the broad criteria as we go through subdivision 2. As we get into lines 2.3 to 2.32, we see basically a clawback of revenue provision, even though it doesn't say clawback. That's what it would do. It was take the. It refers to all revenues earned. Is there a time limit that the company that had done the the broadband would be limited to, or is that just open-ended?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, you know, I think that that would be something that would be worth looking at, and we have a couple more committee stops, and I would be in favor of adding a time limit and making that clear. It shouldn't be in perpetuity.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let's even say that you come up with a time limit. When would a company, relative to the subjectivity of this, other than if there is a time limit, be then fully vested in the earnings that they had received? In other words, they're reporting this on their income statement. When would they know for sure that they could then accept that revenue as being truly earned?
We're getting a little afield from the contracting language, but I did give some leeway to Representative Zerwas, Representative Stevenson, if you have a quick response.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, I think that if they're being net neutral, if they're managing their network in net neutral, it would be right away.
Representative Vogel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do feel, you know, you said that it was anything in Section 1. This is definitely in Section 1, and it has the word contract in it, in this wording. And to that question is, yes, it is earned if indeed there isn't a clawback relative to those provisions. You know, in a contract, we'll typically have that you're responsible for warranty work, and companies can accept that and reserve for that. But how would you, if you are a company, reserve for the loss of revenue that you've already earned, not knowing when it might occur and for what reason?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, I guess I would take issue with the premise of your question when you say not knowing for what reason, because if the network is managing its if the ISP is managing its network on a net neutral basis, they would have no liability. I would say that the ISP would operate the same way that you do when anytime you have potential exposure to civil penalties for unlawful activity. Don't engage in the unlawful activity, you don't have exposure to the civil penalties.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, from an accounting standpoint, I would assume most of these companies need an audited financial statement. The first thing that I would ask if I was going to be doing that audit was, if I saw this, is that revenue actually earned? Because there is subjectivity and there's no time limit going back to say that this can be clawed back. So how are you, excuse me, how are you addressing that the companies wouldn't have a bad audit or something in the opinion letter saying that there's question as to whether or not the revenue is earned, going back to the comments that were made with these companies not maybe wanting to enter into these contracts? And that's where I'm going with this, is what assurance, how would you allow the accounting firm to say, yes, we say that these statements are true and factual, because apparently with this they could claw back those revenues at any time that they felt that any of these somewhat subjective criteria were not met.
Sure, Representative Vogel, that does deal with private companies' actions. You know, the jurisdiction of this committee is the contracts with state governments and with local governments, but Representative Stevenson, if you have a quick response.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, again, I would say that this is analogous to the multitude of provisions in state law that allow for civil penalties to be incurred for unlawful activity. And I don't think that that stops from all sorts of contractors engaging in lawful activity and entering contracts to that point. It doesn't impede audits or on a regular basis when there's the potential for civil penalties if the company engages in unlawful activity. The company just needs to engage only in lawful activity.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do contend that this is relevant, because we are talking about 2.28 to 2.32, and basically a state agency or political subdivision being able to claw back earnings from a private company. That's my understanding. Is that not correct?
Representative Stevenson, is that an accurate statement of what's in the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, I don't necessarily, the word clawback is not in the bill. It does allow civil penalties to be assessed and allows for the return of revenue if the ISP engages in unlawful activity, as I have said. I certainly defer to the chair and to the committee as to the jurisdiction of the committee.
Okay, Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but it says for all revenues earned under the contract. That's why you don't have to say clawback to make it a clawback. What I'm saying here is that for all revenues earned under the contract during the period when the violation occurred. So what we've got here is a bill that is saying that there's some subjectivity relative to the enforcement, that any state agency or political subdivision can basically take back the earnings of a company because they've already put it in as revenue. And I won't go further with it. I know I'm not welcome to do that, but I do believe that we have some serious concerns that passing this out of this committee at this point is not appropriate relative to the contract.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. I don't have any further members on the list to speak. Representative Stevenson, do you have any closing remarks?
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, this is an important issue. It's a very important consumer protection issue, and I appreciate the committee's and ask for the committee's support.
Thank you. The roll call has been requested. Ready to go? Okay, the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Bonner.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
Yes.
Representative Gomez.
Yes.
Representative Cagle.
Yes.
Representative Lee.
Yes.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski.
No.
Representative Sauk.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas.
No.
Representative Heinrich.
No.
Representative Lehman.
No.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Quam.
Nay.
Representative Tice. Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative West.
Okay, there being 10 ayes and 8 nays, the motion is adopted. Representative Stevenson, your bill is on its way. Representative Carlson, L. So thank you for your patience. while he's coming to the table, I will move that House File 769 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And I understand there is an author's amendment here as well. Representative Carlson, would you like me to move the author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that would get the bill in the order that we would like to present the bill.
Sure. I will move the amendment coded A19-0084. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion is adopted. The bill is in the shape you would like. Chair Carlson, if you could please present your bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just by way of a little background, this bill deals with the Public Employee Labor Relations Board. We passed legislation in 2014 creating a three-member board, and the idea is to hear cases involving unfair labor practices. The reason for the bill initially was that currently it would have to go into the district courts, which would be a much slower and much more expensive process. So several states, including now Minnesota, have adopted this approach. And we did provide for the opportunity for rulemaking and so on, and we're prepared now for the next step. Much of the language that was before you was housekeeping, and ultimately the role of Ways and Means will be to provide continuing funding for the board. But it's a three-member board, two members appointed by the governor, and one member appointed by the other two jointly agreeing, and a third member of the board. And so I have with me Nicole Blissenbach and Jonathan Bone to comment about the bill. And then also available is Mike Stockstead from BMS. The last committee in labor, there was a question as to what their position was. And so we've invited that person to attend. I've never met him, so I don't know. Well, there he is. Maybe I have met him, but he's available for questions if need be. So, Mr. Chairman, if we could have Nicole Blissenbach comment first.
Sure. And just for the committee's interest, you know, there, I know there's data practices provisions in here. That's traditionally the jurisdiction of judiciary or civil law. There is an open meeting law change in Section 3, and that's within the jurisdiction of this committee. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nicole Blissenbach, and I currently serve as the chair of the Public Employment Relations Board. The Public Employment Relations Board was created during the 2014 legislative session to process and decide charges of unfair labor practices under the Public Employment Labor Relations Act, or PELRA. The board is made up of three members and three alternate members. One member and one alternate represent public employers or management. One member and one alternate represent public employees. And one member and one alternate represent the public at large. Initially, the board was allocated $125,000 as part of its creation to essentially become operational and get rules drafted and through the rulemaking process. However, in order to actually conduct business, the board will need additional resources, and so that's part of our bill. Members of the board asked this committee to support this this bill, which, as you said, as Representative Carlson said, appropriates additional money and also has changes to the data practices law and the open meeting law. The board was patterned after other state agencies. In fact, of the 35 states that have unfair labor practices, 32 of them have agencies like this one to process unfair labor practice charges that are filed. So in order to fulfill this process, the PERB will need to hire staff in order to do investigations, hearing officers in order to run hearings, and we'll need this additional funding to do that. The amendments to the Data Practices Act and the Open Meeting Law are essentially changes that are critical to the operation of the board. The language will provide clear guidance to those who appear in front of the board as to how the data will be treated, the data in the board's hand will be treated. And then also it will exempt the board from certain aspects of the open meeting law for things like deliberations of cases. We're a three-member board, so when any two of us are talking about deliberations of a case, the open meeting law would apply. And I kind of look at it as similar. We're taking kind of the role of a court of appeals, the three-member board will be when reviewing hearing officer decisions, and so deliberations would be exempt from the open meeting law.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Blissenbach. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, and I have Jonathan Bowen.
Yep,
comments.
Sure, I have him on the list. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Jonathan Bowen. I represent the InterFaculty organization. We are more than 4,000 members around the state, including all of the professors, coaches, librarians, and counselors at the state universities. But I'm also here representing a broad coalition of public employee unions, which supports the full implementation of PERB. With the full implementation of PERB, employees have an accessible forum to challenge unfair labor practices. The current process is prohibitively costly and takes far too long to find a remedy. PERB creates an accessible forum to challenge unfair labor practices, and we urge you to make sure the process is adequately funded to offer those meaningful remedies. A list of our coalition partners includes Law Enforcement Labor Services, Education Minnesota, Minnesota AFL-CIO, AFSCME Council 65, Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, the Nurses Association, Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1005, International Union of Operating Engineers Local 70, IFO, Middle Management Association, Minnesota School Employees Association, AFSCME Council 5, Teamsters Local 320, Laborers District Council of Minnesota North Dakota, SEIU, the Minnesota Government Engineering Council, and more. The creation of the PERB was a significant step forward in bringing the protections of PELRA to employees, and it is extremely important that the PERB is successful. We thank you for your support.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Bone. I know Mr. Stockstead is here if necessary. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. For those folks who are not familiar with us, we're an all-volunteer organization of attorneys, folks that work in the media, folks that work in communications, and we're focused on transparency and openness in government operations. I'm going to speak specifically to the open meeting law provisions of this bill. We generally, because of the nature of our organization, have hesitations when we see closures of open meeting law activity starting to occur in bills, especially if there's been ongoing open meetings for some time. Then we're concerned about asking questions about why is there a need to close what has been an open process in the past. So, you know, we bring that hesitancy to this process. On a technical matter, whether or not the committee decides with us that this may be something that should remain open as opposed to closed, if you decide to close these meetings, there is a better technical process than making an exemption. If you make an exemption, you're going to miss out on some other transparency prerogatives under the existing law. For instance, if you make these meetings subject to the open meeting law but close them as opposed to making them exempt, then you still get notice about who attends the meeting. There's notice about when the meeting's closed. And in the context that's closest, the closest analog to this context that we're discussing now, under existing law, there's a recording of closed labor negotiation sessions under 13.03. And those are recorded and made available to the public upon request after the sessions are complete. So our suggestion would be if you go down the road of trying to close them, don't make them exempt, but include analogs from other parts of the open meeting law that would eventually make part of the content public to public requesters. And I'd be happy to take discuss what those specific changes would be, and I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none. Representative Carlson, did you have
a... No, I was just asking Ms. Blissenbach if she wanted to respond.
Okay. Sure. Ms. Blissenbach, would you care to respond?
I can respond. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In direct response to that, first of all, this isn't making an exemption to what has been existing in the past. The board has not been operational yet, so the open meeting law changes are addressing a specific issue that we realized after the initial law was passed that would require the deliberations in a case that is in front of the board to be done during an open meeting. You know, like I mentioned earlier, a similar process would be requiring like the three-judge panel at the Court of Appeals to do their deliberations in public. As part of that process, there will be different versions of decisions that go back and forth between the members of the board. That does not, it just doesn't work with the open meeting process. You know, in any hearings in front of the board will be noticed as open meetings, and in fact the data practices provision of this amendment sets forth what data will be public and available to the public. And so really it's just that one purpose of the deliberations on decisions that the board makes through this process, this basically appeals process, this agency process, would be exempt from the open meeting law. So it's just that one small portion of what we do. There were concerns brought with their initial bill about exempting the hiring authority, and that was what was dealt with today in the amendment. We removed that provision, and that did satisfy the individuals who raised issues with concern to that open meeting law piece. Thank you.
Thank you. So, yeah, so looking at that with Ms. Blissenbach, just with the change, so if you look at lines 2.25 to 2.30, so the exemption applies to discussions of unfair labor practice charges, orders of hearing officers, and unfair labor practices, and then it looks like the amendment deleted the language related to hiring authority. So those three that are left, I mean, would you say those are mainly judicial or quasi-judicial type proceedings? Ms. Wilson-Bach?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. They are essentially deliberations and the potential of going back and forth on what the actual opinion says and revisions to that opinion.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any member discussions? Okay. Well, thank you. Did you have any closing remarks, Representative Carlson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, the appropriation part of it will be handled in ways and means, but appreciate the discussion here today and I'd like to thank the committee.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 769, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Motion. Aye.
Okay. Motion carries. Representative Kunesh Podin. While you are coming here, I will move that House File 70 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. If you could, and there's no amendments, so if you could please present your bill, Representative Kunesh Podin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. This is the last stop in the process of bringing this task force to the floor of the House of Representatives and asking for a truly bipartisan agreement on the issue of the missing and murdered Indigenous women in Minnesota. This bill will create a task force with a number of membership, including two representatives from the House and two representatives from the Senate. It will include 11 representatives, one from each of our tribal communities. It will include law enforcement, prosecutors, judges, defense attorneys, tribal government officials, non-government agencies, especially those that are working with our Indigenous women and girls, boys and men's and Two-Spirit. And our request today is to bring this to the General Register so that we can make this a viable action, a viable task force, and move on to study the very serious and historic trauma of our missing and murdered Indigenous folks in Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Kunesh Podin. I have four people on the list to testify, Nicole Matthews, Misty Babineau, Mary Lyons, and Sheila Lamb. Is there anyone else in the audience who is planning to on this bill? Okay.
Not thank you.
Okay. Okay. Potentially one, it looks like. Okay, that's fine. Should Nicole Matthews go first?
Sure.
Did you go in this order, or did you have a
that's first? Perfectly fine.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you. Buju and Dinawe Maganang, Nicole Matthews, Jaganashimun, Manidu Bene Shikwe Indigo, Migizi Indo Dame. Greetings, my relatives. My English name is Nicole Matthews, and my Indian name is Bear Bird Woman. I'm Eagle Clan, and I'm from the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. I'm truly honored to have the opportunity to speak with you today on House File 70, a bill to create a task force on murdered and missing Indigenous women. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Indian Women Sexual Assault Coalition, which is a statewide tribal coalition and a national tribal technical assistance provider. Our coalition membership spans the entire state and includes individual and organizational representatives from all tribal communities and includes urban representation as well. In addition, we provide technical assistance to tribes and community organizations across the country who are addressing sexual violence, sex trafficking, and including our murdered and missing Indigenous relatives. I was one of five interviewers for our research on prostitution and trafficking of American Indian and Alaska Native women in Minnesota, where we interviewed 105 of our Native sisters about their experiences being used in prostitution and trafficking. The title of our report is Garden of Truth, The Prostitution and Trafficking of Native Women in Minnesota. One of the things we heard from many of the women we interviewed was that they knew of someone who had been trafficked and they had never seen nor heard from them again. We heard story after story of the violence and invisibility they encountered on a daily basis. One woman said that a sex buyer told her, "I thought we killed all of you." This is the same violence and invisibility that many of us encounter on a daily basis. We are Indigenous to this land, and we deserve better. Thanks to a report that was recently published by the Urban Indian Health Institute, we are starting to see data on this issue. We know, however, that there is more data out there, and all of the data represents real human life. Someone's mother, someone's daughter, someone's sister, someone's auntie, and someone's friend. In 2016, Rose Downwind was missing and found murdered by her partner. That same year, we lost Tanya Skinaway Sam, who was also murdered by her partner. And last year, on January 29, 2018, we lost Lene Strong, who was murdered here in St. Paul. In addition, we know of many missing relatives, including Sheila St. Clair, JoJo Boswell, and April Geyer, just to mention a few. There are many more stories similar to the ones I've mentioned, and there are stories that are yet to be told, stories that we don't hear in the media, stories from our Indigenous trans sisters, stories that have been forgotten or deemed unimportant. These stories are not just numbers for us. They represent a loss to our community and to our families, and it is time for Minnesota to acknowledge the responsibility to the Indigenous women on whose land we sit today. Minnesota has long been a leader on issues of gender-based violence, and creating a task force to address murdered and missing Indigenous women is a great way to continue that legacy. Miigwech, thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. D. Babineau. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Misty Babineau. I live in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. I'm a climate justice organizer and registered lobbyist with Minnesota 350, Minnesota 350 Action. Today, I sit in front of you as a citizen of the Red Lake Nation, as a near trafficking survivor and a victim of so many traumas. I had my virginity taken from me when I was 9 years old. He was the boyfriend of my foster mother at the time and the man of a cloth. I told my social worker, she didn't believe me. I told my foster mother, she didn't believe me. I told my teachers and they didn't believe me. I was making it up. I was a troubled child looking for attention. When I was 12 years old, I was saved. There was a woman who took me into her heart and into her home. We were up north visiting the family for the weekend, where I witnessed my cousin stab my grandma in the aorta. She was dead before she hit the ground. That woman then came after me. I have the scars on my hand today from where I grabbed that knife, from where she tried to plunge it into my chest. When I was 20, I was living in a rural town about an hour north of where we sit today. I was kidnapped, held against my will, transported over 60 miles away. I was raped at gunpoint and my life was threatened. But I got away. Many of my sisters are not this lucky. And I want you to look at my sisters who are here today. Any one of them could be here telling this story today. And I just want to take a moment to address the police officers who work in human trafficking. This is not a hot button issue. This is for everybody listening. This isn't just something that is trendy, that's getting headlines now. Our people have been facing this epidemic since the day the colonists originally stepped foot on this land. Our women are not vulnerable. We are targeted. And it is time for healing and for justice for so many of us. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony and for sharing your story. Mary Lyons is next on the list.
I'm going to read mine because I always like a little bit of humor when you mix in with a lot of the disparities. So I'm going to read this, otherwise we will be here until 9:30 tonight. Good morning, and thank you for sharing the space to address the hidden problem of the missing and murdered Indigenous women. My name is great-grandmother Mary Lyons. I'm an Anishinaabe. I'm an enrolled member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I would like to share a thought with you all of our hidden history that you will not find in your history books, and hopefully have a better understanding of why not to say They just need to get over it. So let me begin with this. I often wonder if the generational trauma from the removal of Indian children from loving families 100 years plus ago has taught today's society that back then it was wrong. The repercussions would be devastating. Within 100 years lifespan events, let me introduce a scenario to you. A Native daughter is taken from her family, placed into a religious institution, a place where she will be safe and to be educated into the likes of the white man's expectations. Only to venture into a world of cruelty, of being beaten for speaking the only language she knew, and then being sexually assaulted for selfish reasonings. Then, if you're lucky enough to escape this brutality and re-enter the world just to be told that now you have to relocate and learn another trade to work in this world. They venture into another institution to only be degraded and again face the malice of men that felt they could do as a priest because they were doing society a favor by making them human in their liking. In the early 1900s to mid-1900s, there was no therapy for these women to seek help for their emotional scarring. They couldn't even seek their native religious ceremonies as it was outlawed. It was only until 1978 the Indian Religious Act became legal for our people to do what we have been doing since the beginning of time. So many sought out alcohol as it numbed the pain, took them away from the night terrors until they became so dependent on it until it became an addiction. This avenue would prove to be harmful, not only to them, but to their children. The dependency of alcohol also brought harm in the form of deficiencies of growth while in the womb. Today we call fetal alcohol syndrome. For Native children, this was so new to them and the communities at large, this disability would be another lifetime imprisonment. Here is where I strongly suggest each and every one here that are making decisions for the people, read up on these diagnoses, where you will have a better understanding of the generations that follow what their behaviors are limited to. Today we classify them as disabled with extreme vulnerabilities. Not only the removal of the Relocation Acts took a toll on their communities, society continued to hide the truth of their involvements by saying it just didn't happen. Then with all past came the present. The removal of children would continue to happen. Children are removed and placed into foster care, often away from their cultures. These children are often not tested for disabilities of the fallout of the misuse of alcohol. This was and is my mother and sister's story. My mother died young from a diabetic coma related to alcoholism. The county felt my father was too old to care for their younger children, so they placed him into foster care. This bill of the MMIW is very important to me because it has affected our family, friends, as well as our community. On December 31st of 1989, that evening my sister Catherine Louise Lyons Jones went home to change and returned to an evening of fun at the Minneapolis American Indian Center sobriety powwow. That was the last time we seen her alive. When she went home with her baby and my older sister, they walked into her apartment to find her estranged boyfriend in the house drunk holding a knife. My older sister reported that he lunged at our younger sister while she was holding their son and began stabbing her. She dropped the baby and my older sister went into shock. He continued to stab her to death and her full body was opened as if she had heart and abdominal surgery. Then he ran out of the door. The baby climbed on top of his mother crying and wanted her to embrace him, comfort him, as he often did when he was hurt and scared. The neighbors called the police as they often did and within moments they came with an ambulance and fire department. My elder sister was still in shock that left her body frozen. The baby was drowning in his mother's blood and his little arms were stuck in her ribs. When the fireman came in, he said he had to break her ribcage to release his little arm and resuscitate him. Forgive me, this is so hard.
Take your time.
that evening could have been prevented. There's no doubt in my mind that she'd be alive today if the police officers in the past 10 months prior to her death would have done their jobs the correct way. My younger sister had restraining orders on this man, and every time he showed up, she called the police and they would dismiss the situation. At one time, a police officer told her to stop taking him back and misleading him. A week prior to this tragedy, he showed up pounding on her door in the middle of the night, and she called the police. The police came, she showed him the restraining order, and they just told him to go home, and this was their final warning. If the police would have just arrested him, he would still be alive today. He had a number of violations dismissing this restraining order, which would have put him in jail, but my sister, a woman of color, and a boyfriend that was Caucasian, wasn't on fair ground when it came to protection. And no, it was not domestic. It was stalking her, and the courts knew it. I have raised three boys, her boys, the boys that should have called her mom and not me. These boys grew into men. The eldest chose not to have children as the scars are deep. The middle son carries distrust and has never fully healed and relives her death over and over again every New Year's Eve. The baby boy that nearly died with her on that tragic night grew up, went into the Marine Corps, had a family. Today he is out of the Marine Corps on a medical after nearly two terms. He suffers from post-traumatic stress as he gets afraid when they disagree. He does not know how to handle arguments as he fears he might carry the same ill will as his biological father had done. So in order to keep her and his son safe, he chose to walk away from the marriage as he feels it's unfair to her of this pain that he cannot heal from. The list of these young men have gone through and continue is difficult and certainly unfair justice. The movement of children from out-of-home placements have proven to do more harm than good in the earlier years. How does foster care and adoption today relate to the MMIW? We need to embrace the entire picture of the missing and murdered individual to find our solutions. We have no sound, reliable evidence other than the cost of foster care and adoption here in Minnesota. We have one of the highest placements of foster care. DHS alone in 2017 reported approximately 185 children each week go into foster care. Over 50% of Minnesota's homeless youth have been in foster care or adopted. In Minnesota, approximately 2,000 children age out of the foster care system every year, of which over 38% do not have a plan to get health insurance, a job, housing, or a driver's license. The majority of these children have diagnoses that cost them as vulnerable adults, and this information gets lost when they turn 18. The majority of indigenous women that fell through the cracks were in generational out-of-home placements, such as foster care and adoption, and through the medical history, they too were classified as vulnerable adults. On a closing note, we must embrace another truth. There is this unspoken portion of missing and murdered women and mothers that were going to school, they were working, and they were even in healthy relationships. They weren't drunks, drug addicts, prostitutes, unfit individuals of society, as many may think. I just want you to think about that. The vulnerability of people when they're released into the public, especially if they're fetal alcohol. They appear to be 18 legally, but they may have the mind of a 10-year-old. Would you expect these young adults to respond as an adult when somebody says, come over here, I want to show you something, or I love you? They have the tendency of believing them. So we have a bigger picture here and a larger responsibility. Because within this missing and murdered woman, it just doesn't cover Native American women. This is across the globe. So when we look at this, and when we speak for a people as we should do, we have to look at the entirety of the picture. So this, I want to say, Chimi Gretchen, thank you for listening.
Thank you for sharing your story. Last testifier I have is Sheila Lamb.
Buju, Sheila Lamb, Indishinaka Jaganashimong, Anangu Kwe Indigo Ojibwaimong, Mingan Indu Dame. My name is Sheila Lamb. My Ojibwe name is Star Woman, and I am Wolf Clan. I am also a Cloquet City Council member, Executive Director of All Nations Indigenous Center, and a group leader with Lifehouse, working with trafficked and at-risk young ladies under the age of 18. Every week, I look in the eyes of children that have been abused, trafficked, and mistreated, the majority of which are Indigenous young women. In Cloquet, with a population of under 12,000 people, we are battling sex trafficking among our Indigenous youth. Most recently, it was four middle school girls being trafficked by an older boy, but we don't know where the head of that snake really is coming from. I have two teenage daughters still at home, ages 14 and 16, that I've had to educate from a very early age as Native children the fears and concerns of walking alone, even in their own neighborhood, to go two blocks down the street to the library. We've watched Cloquet, Bemidji, and Duluth recently being groomed by sex traffickers. And after going to a recent training for city councilors and mayors and talking with other council members, we find that though we have 70% of our Minnesota cities with populations of 4,000 and less, they too are dealing with sex trafficking. And there is a long, long history of this going on. More and more often, we hear of those missing and murdered, the Sheila St. Clairs or the Jeremy Jourdains. Every day on Facebook and through various aspects of social media, we hear of 2, 3, 5 missing Indigenous people. It's primarily our young women, but it's also our young men. But trust me, no one sitting here today is exempt from knowing this type of pain, because it affects all of us. When you talk to police departments, the lack of training and education is devastating. When you work as an advocate trying to get help, hearing that a child has been put into foster care and is being molested, raped, trafficked, and you go agency to agency, it's daunting and the help isn't there. The mental health help is not there adequately. And we are truly targeted, though we are only 2% of the population in the nation. We're exotic. We're different. We're subhuman. We aren't supposed to exist any longer. And as a council member, I have already dove in fully, because I was made aware of this as an Indigenous woman while knocking on doors for my campaign. People within my own small community begging for help. Not just Indigenous people, teachers, social workers, friends, and neighbors that are watching children as young as the age of 5 being trafficked. We know the industries that are involved, the Super Bowl, the pipelines, but we don't know where all of this leads to each and every time, because the help and the support and the studies aren't there. When we try to gain statistics, we're told that we have such insignificant numbers due to being 2% of the population that we don't matter. It would be skewed. Without a task force such as this, this problem will continue to grow. And our women, our children, our babies will continue to die. And the layers of multi-generational historical trauma will keep being added. As a mother of one son and 3 daughters, I can tell you that the 4 females in my family, including myself with my children, 3 of us have experienced sexual violence. all four of us know abuse. And I'm an educated woman. I'm supposed to be smarter than that. We can't keep ourselves safe without help, no matter how diligent or how educated or how well-versed on this we are. The threats are very real. And we need help and support. And I am beyond grateful to see this bill so that when I go back to work and I look at these young women that are suffering from this, I can tell them there's hope. That we're addressing it and that Minnesota is standing up for a very real problem. And I would like to be able to go on March 12th to the United Nations when I speak on the issues of sex trafficking and say Minnesota is totally standing up to help our women, our children, and our men and our families. So I implore you to pass this bill and to give the indigenous community the help, the support, and the healing that we desperately need.
Thank you, Councilmember Lamb. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this bill? Okay. Welcome. And if you could please come to the table, just state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Buju, Asanoikle, Indigenous Cause, Gaba Babigani Cog, and Dunjaba, Ajijak, and Dudame. My name is Ashley Fairbanks. I live in Minneapolis, but I'm a citizen of the White Earth Nation. I just wanted to speak especially to the timeliness of doing this work. You know, so most folks in Minnesota only get 1 week in fifth grade or sixth grade of education about Native issues. So I assume even a lot of people in this room don't know kind of the reality on the ground about the legal situation for protection of Native women. Well, Native people, but especially Native women, right? Most of our protections solely come from the Violence Against Women Act. Our tribes have no ability to prosecute non-Native offenders of violence and sexual violence. I'm going to try to breathe a little bit, but I have five nieces who live on the reservation, and if a non-Native man were to come there and commit a violent act against them, our tribal police have no ability to prosecute them. And 2 weeks ago, the Violence Against Women Act was allowed to lapse, which means that there's women, Native women across the country right now who have no legal protection. No one's coming to help us, you know. We need local action, and before we can take action, we need to know that the realities of what's happening. And it's not just on our reservations. This discussion frequently just gets limited to that. But as especially the opioid crisis increases in our urban cores, Native women, you know, over 50% of our population lives in our urban cores. They're the most vulnerable. They're vulnerable to sex trafficking. They're vulnerable to abuse on the street. And, you know, frequently they get in a limbo between going between home reservation communities where they have no protection and urban communities where they're basically invisible. So I encourage you guys to really invest your time and energy in learning about the issue and to make sure that we have a permanent plan for how we come up with a solution to help the Native women here in our state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Fairbanks. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, Representative Quam, you have a question or comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And frankly, you know, especially the people listening, but the members, too often the evil that we've heard about here, we think of it as just being in books, on TV, and movies. But it exists in its or dim history, and it exists today. And it could be, well, my wife avoided a abduction when she lived overseas. And it can happen to anyone. Often we don't know because people aren't brave enough to come up in public and speak about it. And to the author, please involve retired judges, because many members have worked on trafficking bills, Representative Pinto and others that are present. And we have to revisit, because
It goes a court case and there's a loophole, mm-hmm. or there's a technicality. And frankly, I really hope that by involving a diverse group of people mm-hmm. and retired judges, you can foresee and avoid those occurrences, because evil must be, we have to be diligent mm-hmm. and fight against it and prevent. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nash?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kunesh-Podein. I think I've seen this 7 times now, and I'm glad you have kept going. Yep. This is a good bill. You and I have talked offline about this, and I appreciate your diligence on this. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kunesh-Podein. I think there's probably no secret in this room that I have been a strong supporter of this bill for a very long time through my work with Women's March. And just personally, this issue is one that I feel very deeply. And I feel for the testifiers, and I want to thank them for their courage being here today. Some of you, I think, have come from long distances to be here with us today. And we want you to realize that as we listen to you today, that you are not invisible, that we see you. And I think that I want to thank you, Representative Kunesh-Podein, for continuing forward with this bill and continuing to push for it. I think that at a certain point we need to acknowledge the wisdom and the role that women play within our indigenous tribes and within their communities. They nurture our communities. They build our communities. And if we cannot take time to address this issue and make the invisible become visible, for the least among us, the folks who are the most vulnerable, then I think that speaks a great deal to the greater impact that that has on our society as a whole. So I want to say thank you, Representative Kunesh-Podein, and thank you to the testifiers. I will definitely be supporting this bill.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Are there any additional member questions or comments? Seeing none, any closing remarks? Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and of course, thank you to the testifiers who have testified time and time again. Those stories are not easy to listen to, and they're certainly not easy to tell. And so those women and those community members that have come forward time and time again to support this effort, I can't thank you enough from the bottom of my heart. I also thank all of the representatives that have shown overwhelming support for this bill. Representative Quam and Representative Nash were all of you, you were there the last year when we started hearing these bills and were so emotionally impacted by it. And if you look at the support on this bill, we have, I'm sure, close to 100% support on both sides of the aisle. So this is truly a bipartisan piece of legislation. We're hoping to carry it through to the Senate. And to respond to Representative Quam's statement, we don't know where this is going to take us. It's going to open up a lot of old wounds. It's going to open up a bit of a Pandora's box. And we will be looking for any and all those that can support us in this effort, whether they are assigned to this task force or they have information or knowledge that they can share with us. We'll be looking for, you know, a statewide system of collecting data, acknowledging the situation, addressing those social issues, those emotional issues that we hear about, as well as creating a good communication and data collection form across our state so that we don't have this kind of inconsistency anymore. So, Mr. Chair, I thank you for this opportunity. I thank our representatives, and again, I thank all of the testifiers and the communities that have supported me and supported all of us so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kunesh-Podein. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 70 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Kunesh-Podein. Representative Purcell. Um, I will move that House File 758 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Would you like to describe your bill, Representative Purcell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This bill 758 is put together to address issues that have arisen, I guess is the right word, in the past regarding the Mississippi Headwaters Board. And this Headwaters Board was created decades ago in order to maintain state control of the upper reaches of the Mississippi River and the corridor. So over the years there had been some back and forth and with the various jurisdictions, with counties, townships, etc., about managing zoning in this corridor along the headwaters of the Mississippi. And so the language here is in the bill is intended to make it clear to all involved that the Headwaters Board does have zoning jurisdiction, and I've talked with a lot of folks up in the upper reaches, including my own township, and my township, Frone Township, does have zoning authority, and I've been assured that under the auspices of this bill and preceding bill, that the most stringent zoning will apply. And there were some who were concerned about that, but I'll stop there and stand for questions.
Sure. Is there anyone who would like to speak on House File 758? Seeing none, any member question or discussion? Okay, seeing none, with that.
Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Purcell, can you talk about the full scope and who's got zoning authority in this? Because I didn't hear that. And what's the authority that they're going to have? How far will it extend out? If you maybe could clarify that for us.
Sure. That might be a good question for House Research, too. Would you like to answer, Representative?
I'll take a stab at it, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
And the zoning authority is 1,000 feet to either side of the river, jurisdictional authority. This bill just is to clarify that the Headwaters, Mississippi Headwaters Board, does have that jurisdictional authority. There's been challenges to that, is how I'll say that, over the, I'm aware of one in the last several years. This is to clarify. That's the intent of the bill. And the most stringent zoning applicable will apply. If it's not the Headwaters Board, if it's my township, then that applies.
Okay. Representative Nash?
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Purcell, we can follow up offline, but that's sort of the crux of the question is, that interjurisdictional back and forth that is going to be created or strengthened or whatever. Having served as a local elected official, it's oftentimes kind of touchy as to when that jurisdiction might be taken away from a city or a township. So that's obviously a conversation we want to make sure is had, but also clearly defined, so that it is absolutely clear as day, so that mayors and township supervisors understand that, as well as the people who turn to those folks for clarification and help. So just trying to make sure that I understand that so I can maybe weigh in one way or another, whether I'm going to vote for it or not. I'm sure you're waiting for that news flash to come across, but I think that everybody in this committee is going to want to know how clearly defined that is and what, honestly, the folks from the townships and the cities in that area also think of this.
Representative Purcell?
I may have to choose my words better, and I'll come up with some phraseology, because I will appreciate support, because it is important. The jurisdiction of the Headwaters Board is to be intact, but if the regulations, the zoning regulations for a township or a city are more stringent, then those regulations apply. That was something I needed to make sure was there because of the township I live in, and I got to go back there and sleep, you know. So that's and we have Mississippi River going right through. So I hope that answered it. I'll think on that, and perhaps on the floor I can clarify it better.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and probably in the same line as Representative Nash. What I'm probably struggling with is clarity, and similar to Representative Nash, I know how these sort of things can almost develop their own conflict without being able to look at it in the future. One of the things I'm thinking about is, because we're dealing with the nature of a part of our universe that's water, and we're going to have zoning jurisdiction, which to me would almost by definition impact that first 1,000 feet, if that's the barrier description, that first 1,000 feet of impact to the water, runoffs, and all of the things that will go into that. So has there been discussions on how that sort of thing is going to get sorted out so that there's clarity of understanding? Or is it just that you're going to put them all in a big gymnasium and, you know, they're going to have to sort out how they have influence on each of these different parts of the environment?
Representative Purcell.
I will try and say how I understand it. And each entity, not every, because some townships have not accepted jurisdiction over Mississippi River, for instance. But counties and some cities certainly have for development purposes. And so they have procedures and, you know, zoning authorities and that they've established and that's laid out in, you know, in the verbiage and the words. When questions come up, well, then they're going to refer back to the language of each individual authority, and the more stringent applies. If it says, you know, if one of them says you can have 10 homes and, you know, every 100 feet along a river, or a home every 100 feet, and another authority says you can only have a home every 200 feet, well, the 200 feet is going to win. This bill does not set that in, didn't set that into motion. This bill clarifies that.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 758 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you. Representative Schultz, thank you for your patience. While you are coming down, I will move that House File 90 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways. Re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. Representative Schultz, if you would please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 90 is the what I call the elder care bill. It's the bill that will address elder abuse. It's a response to the multitude of stories from families we have heard last year and this year about widespread and often horrific and unthinkable abuse of older and vulnerable adults living in assisted living establishments and nursing homes. The bill before you today seeks to address the problem of elder abuse in a systematic, multifaceted way. For today's hearing, I would like to focus on two sections of House File 90 that I believe are within the jurisdiction of this committee. First, in Article 1, Section 13, we provide protections for residents of assisted living establishments against arbitrary discharges and service terminations, a complaint we hear over and over again from families in Minnesota. The portion of this section that is relevant to this committee starts on line 28.6. In the nursing home context, if a resident is served with a discharge notice, the resident has the right to appeal to the Office of Administrative Hearings. There are about 20 appeals per year, as most of the disputes are worked out among the providers, the residents, and families, or resolved with the help of the Ombudsman for long-term care. This provision in House File 90 creates a parallel system for residents in assisted living establishments, giving them the right to appeal a discharge or service termination to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Second, House File 90 establishes a licensing system for assisted living establishments. Incredibly, Minnesota is the only state in the nation that does not license these assisted living facilities. I'm happy to report that the providers, the consumers, and the Department of Health, under the leadership of Commissioner Malcolm, have coalesced around a structure that would establish three tiers of licensure, a basic tier, a comprehensive tier, and a dementia care tier. Article 4 of House File 90 sets forth the licensing parameters, and the very last section, beginning on line 75.5, directs the Department of Health to engage in expedited rulemaking to implement the licensing provisions and requirements found in Article 4. We understand that it takes time to set up a licensing system, but at the same time, it is imperative that we move to licensing as soon as possible. All stakeholders agree on that principle. Therefore, the bill calls for expedited rulemaking to get things moving as quickly as possible. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for hearing this bill. I hope you will support it. I also want to thank our advocates and providers for working on the language with the Department of Health.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Looks like you have a testifier.
We do have testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg and members of the committee. I'm Chris Sundberg, and I'm president of Elder Voice Family Advocates. And we are family members who've had a mother, father, or other loved one experience some terrible abuse in a senior living facility somewhere throughout the state. Today I speak for Elder Voice, AARP, and Legal Aid in support of House File 90. And thank you very much, Representative Schultz. Passage of this bill is critically important to improve the quality and safety of the care given at assisted living facilities, which now dominate senior living options. Since this committee is focused on just a few sections of this bill, I'll comment only on the right to appeal arbitrary discharges and terminations. It's important to understand that arbitrary termination notices often cause severe hardship for the resident and their family. It's imperative that they have the right to appeal the termination. This will give them time to work with the facility to either develop a plan to address the concerns or the time to find another suitable residence. We have several examples. For instance, one of our members was given a termination notice on December 22, 2016, and told to be out in 30 days. This family believes it was in direct retaliation for their involving the state's ombudsman's office, as well as documenting their care concerns and trying to work with the facility in getting this care addressed. The resident died a month ago, and I'd like to read to you from his obituary, which was published in the Star Tribune a week ago, Sunday, February 24. And it states, since August 2016, when Bob could no longer be cared for at home, he endured two assisted living facilities and a skilled nursing home. I won't go into the details, but their experience of subpar care and the wife's futile attempts to safeguard her husband was a torturous 2.5 years. Another member has been threatened with eviction of her mother if the daughter were to put in a camera in her private room. Now, the daughter has an upcoming trip out of the country in April, and she's terrified as an only child to leave for fear of what might happen to her mother in her absence. Now, keep in mind, this mother's already suffered 2 amputations of her legs because of inadequate care that was received. There's another situation happening right now in Albert Lea, where a facility is attempting to split up a husband and wife who have been living together in the assisted living facility for the past 7 years. The husband, a retired physician, is giving additional care for his wife, and he wants to continue to do that. And as a retired physician, he has stated there's been absolutely no change in his wife's condition that would warrant this, but nonetheless, the facility is not willing to work with them. They just desperately want to stay where they're at and to enjoy their 60th wedding anniversary together. And additionally, keep in mind that people with dementia, this is particularly traumatic, and it often compounds their cognitive problems. One of our members had to move their mother 3 times to 3 different facilities, and one time they were only given 24 hours. This shouldn't be happening. There are many more instances of arbitrary discharge and termination of services, but I think you've got the point here. These arbitrary discharges cause serious trauma when they aren't given an opportunity to challenge the decision or given time or help to find another residence to move to.
If you could
thank
wrap
you
up your testimony.
I'm done. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Sorry. Is there anyone else who would like to speak to House File 90? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author of the bill. This is an issue that we've worked on for the last several years and has been challenging. If I remember the discussion around kind of the when individuals have to move from housing, from kind of the assisted living to a more skilled nursing facility, one of the concerns is if an individual is at an assisted living facility, has some type of medical episode, goes to the hospital, and then when the individual is discharged from the hospital, they require a level of care that's no longer offered at the originating facility, and they're not able to accommodate that level of care. And so as we set up the right to appeal termination of housing or services in Section 13 of the bill, I'm looking through, and maybe it's in a different subdivision than where I'm looking, but I'm wondering if it lies out the criteria that the OAH would have to consider if a family does appeal and what that process looks like. Because I totally understand the hardship and the challenges of having to move a loved one, but we've heard of in the past where individuals are being taken care of in assisted living facility during their time there, their dementia or other issues progress, and it's no longer safe for them to remain in that facility. They don't have a locked memory care ward or things of the such. And so I'm just wondering, as you lay out the right to appeal, do we lay out the factors that the OAH would need to consider and whether or not that termination is relevant? You do lay out in the bill that the the assisted living establishment bears the burden of proof to establish the termination of housing or services as permissible. And I'm just wondering what the OAH will be taking into consideration as they make that determination.
There's a lot there. I see somebody has come up. Would you like to speak, Representative Schultz, or should I turn to Mr. Elwood?
Representative Schultz. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe there's language in there for when it's a health-related concern and it's not retaliation, but I'll have Mr. Elwood respond more fully to your question.
Sure. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Representative Zerwas, thanks for the question. I think if you look at lines 20, starting on 25-13, it talks about what the permissible reasons are for the termination, and that would be the basis for the appeal. So the OAH would be determining whether or not it fell within these parameters, and they're pretty well spelled out. And I'd also point out quickly that on line, starting on line 27.13, there is an exception for emergency, just like what you said, exactly what you said, actually. And so these would be the considerations that they would be looking at.
Okay. Representative Zeros? Okay. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to thank Representative Schultz for bringing this forward. I am aware of so many stories where people have been harmed, where they've died, and when I'm talking with people that are living in some of these facilities, the constant comment is that they're not treated with respect. And it's something that's beyond my ken. And I mean, we need to get this bill passed. We need to be doing much, much better with our senior citizens.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. Thanks for bringing the bill forward. We do need to do something. I do have concerns that we're getting too close with the licensing of assisted living to nursing homes, and I'm very cognizant of that. We're having worked with a hospice house, and the reason they tried hard not to be aligned with like nursing care is the look and feel of what the facility may become. That's very important to me because we hear a lot that folks want to remain in a home-like setting, and I'm afraid that if we align licensing of assisted living too much like nursing homes, we're going to lose that home-like setting. And I think that's very important. We hear it from many different areas. When we were in building, it was a big part of what we did is keeping folks in their homes longer and making them feel more comfortable. So I have huge concerns about that piece of it. I don't want it to be like another nursing home. I think folks deserve to have it to be more like a home setting. So if there's a way that we can come to, you can find a way to not align it so much like nursing home, keep it looking more like a home, I'd be a lot more on board. I really think that it's a big part of making them, what do I want to say? Making them more attractive to folks to go to. If it feels more like a home, if it feels more like an institutional setting, that's a turnoff. People have big issues with going to nursing homes. And I think having it more home-like is so important, and that's my concern. Thank you.
Any response, Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you for sharing those concerns. You know, as we transition away from nursing home care, more and more people are going to assisted living, and they don't want to be in an institution like a nursing home particularly, but we need to make sure the people there are safe as they are in nursing homes. So this bill really makes sure that we have licensure to review and monitor and provide oversight to assisted living facilities, so we're protecting people of Minnesota, especially our most vulnerable, as Representative Mason has suggested. So I don't think it will change the look and feel of a assisted living facility. I think the demand is for a home-like environment if it's not their own home, and that we're just trying to protect the people that are using those types of facilities. But I'll have Mr. Elwood, if you want to respond.
Any
Comment, Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tice, quickly, I think the appeals piece is the one that we're sort of saying, well, people should have the same right. But the rest of the bill, if you really look into it, it really preserves the distinctions. And I don't think this bill in any way really goes to where you were concerned about. So we can certainly have that discussion more deeply. And if you'd like, we can visit with you offline. But I think this bill does not do what you're afraid it's going to would do.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And quick clarification, there are some small towns that are trying to address multiple needs. Recently, there was an apartment complex that was built, and they did a partnership with a home care. You know, people would come out and visit, maybe administer medicine or, you know, some functionality. But they offer that availability in coordination with their apartment. So if people want to move in there and they're going to use this, I mean, it's sort of a gray area, but I see it growing in at least in greater Minnesota. Would there be any crossover? What sort of impact on this sort of a gray area would we have? They aren't physically providing staffing in that. They just have a cooperative so that their people know. It's just like some people will allow entities to come in and care for pets or etc. But this is a much more important service.
Representative Schultz, Mr. Elwood,
Mr. Chair, and Representative Quam. I think the way this is set up is it doesn't really change the existing situation with Housing with Services in the sense that you can have an arranged home care provider come in through the facility if that's the connection, or you can have your own private home care provider come in either way. So I think it preserves the same structure, but then puts over that an overlay of some more accountability. Again, every state in America licenses assisted living facilities and has these sort of different levels and allows the kind of flexibility. We're the only state that doesn't.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From my understanding, the community tried to look at an assisted living setting. That wasn't possible. So they talked to someone that was building apartments and said, hey, maybe they make some more accessibility, they add extra outlets, or I'm not sure what the accommodations were for. The apartment complex is not part of anything. So it's, and the people that are coming in are just like they were outside. So what I'm worried about is we won't have people that will build apartments that are accommodating and compatible with an outside group coming in and providing some additional care. And so that's why I'm concerned that this might scare them away, that the apartment complex would have to be licensed, where I don't think if an individual home had the same exact people come in, that home would have to be licensed because it's the person, you understand. So I'm trying to understand, and I was more queasy after you said the umbrella would help cover them. I think that would decrease options in greater Minnesota.
Mr. Elwood.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I didn't understand your question exactly, because if what you're talking about is that this apartment complex is neither providing any kind of home care nor arranging with anybody to provide home care, and the individuals on their own just want to go out and get a provider on their own that has nothing to do with the complex, then I don't think that this wouldn't affect them at all.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I didn't know it would be this complex, because it may include the fact that they, that that company is allowed keys or code access. It's more than just, gee, Domino's is coming and delivering pizza. There is cooperation, but it's not a, you know, included. Maybe if you understand it, there's an overlap that's greater than just being open.
This is getting a little outside the scope of this committee, but Mr. Elwood, if you have a quick response.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quinn, I think I really can allay your concern. Because if the facility you're talking about today does not have to register as a housing with services, then it wouldn't have to be licensed as assisted living. So if it's outside of the scope now, it will be outside of the scope after this bill is passed.
Okay. Sounds good. I don't have any members on the list. Representative Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I totally understand what Representative Quam is trying to get at. I know that in my community, there are homes that are being used for people, for seniors, for various other issues, as well as in the apartment buildings. I mean, there's home care workers in all of those situations.
Yeah, it sounds like his sounds like his concerns were addressed by Mr. Elwood. Thank you, Representative Mason. Don't see any additional members on the list. So, Representative Schultz, any closing remarks?
No, I want to thank the members of the committee and the chair for hearing the bill. I hope you will support it.
Thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 90 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Okay, Representative Lesh. We have House File 804. I will move that House File 804 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. If you could please present your bill, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This House file is the Mary Liz Holberg legacy, among several that she has around here. For those of you who do not know former Representative Holberg, she was a former Republican member. She is now a county commissioner in Scott County. Pretty sure it's Scott County. Is it Dakota County? Well, they all blend together down there south. I can't tell which is which. But she does a great job. And there aren't any of those members on this committee, are there?
Representative Vogel, I think, might have a bit of Scott County.
Oh, shucks.
Mason's Dakota.
But her idea with
you
this...
You deeply
and,
offended the committee, Chair Lesh.
Calm down. Her idea with this is that we would have a commission to train and educate folks, because this data practices stuff, you talk about it, most people's eyes roll into the back of their heads and they start yawning. And so, but it's pretty important stuff, because as we all know, whoever controls the information controls the flow of power, both around this place and then in Minnesota and nationally. So the idea is get people educated about data practices, legislators, and this extends it. It's pretty bipartisan. The commission itself is pretty nonpartisan. So with that, I would introduce Mr. Matt Ayling, who is here with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information.
Welcome back to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Matt Ayling, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. We're here to offer our endorsement of this bill. We were closely involved with the creation of the commission, helping Representative Holberg and Senator Dibble steer it through the committee process, and we're glad to see that it's taken foot here in the legislature. It is part of the reason why Minnesota has had such a long and robust history of government transparency, is because there's been such bipartisan buy-in over such a long period of time, many, many decades, where both Republicans and Democrats have supported the government transparency initiatives we have in the state, including the Data Practices Act, which is a fairly unique statutory construction. A lot of other states in their open records framework use very narrow language. They have some broad categories of language. They're very limited. And then courts interpret how those are applied over time. Here in Minnesota, we took a very different approach. The legislature is vested with all of this activity, paying attention to it and managing the data that the government uses. So that involves a lot of attention to detail and a lot of education. and that's what this commission provides. The commission also provides for looking into technology issues that impact personal privacy. That was another part of its initial mandate. And it has done so in terms of reviewing technology about license plate readers, body cameras, and many other pieces of technology that impact individual privacy. And it continues to do that. So we offer a hearty endorsement of this commission. We hope it continues on. We thank Representative Lesh for his championship of these issues over time. And I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Ayling. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on this bill? Mr. Heller, if you could please come forward.
Thank you, committee. Government operations, my name is Rick Heller. I officially represent the twice exceptional and print disabled. I ask that the minutes would reflect that. Come to testify in John Lesh's bill, the 804. I agree that this needs to be extended, because accessibility also has to do with transparency, for if it's not fully searchable, is it transparent? There's some Heller handouts. I suggest those individuals that are interested to look at those. I think that's relevant to a bill that's being spoken today at Government Operations in the Senate and Kiffmeyer, 1727, a working group to look at accessibility internally for the legislature. However, working groups do not meet public data or the public to be involved in that. So unless you do a commission for accessibility and get a bigger picture, the LCCMR also is looking for about 140, which is part of the lotto dollars. I guess their core plan never included accessibility regarding their documents and their that people apply for and their web pages, once again. And last but least, the word electronic. Every time we use online at the legislature or website requirement that they post it, we need to consider 508 and web content accessibility guidelines, especially for profits and nonprofits, because this relates to people accessing the information effectively. So I would ask that you would approve this budget, and hopefully in the future somebody can consider what the word electronic means as it relates to data practice. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hiller. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And where is this bill going?
It is going to the Ways and Means Committee.
And which committee is it going to go down to after that?
That would be up to the Ways and Means Chair. It seems likely it would go either, or potentially both, to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law, as well as to State Government Finance.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just curious where the money's coming out of, the which budget the money's coming out.
I think it's on your spreadsheet, Mr. Chairman.
Any additional questions from members? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 80. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Bonner? Did you? Okay. I will renew my motion that House File 804 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank
you, Representative Lesh. And last but certainly not least, Chair Dean. We have House File 1487 before us, and I will move House File 1487 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Do you have a couple amendments, Representative Dean, or did you want to present the bill first?
I do, Mr. Chair, and it might be best to start with the amendments. Reason being is some of the questions may get addressed in the amendments. So I have Sam Benowitz from the Office of Secretary of State who can speak to the A2 and then the A3, but first someone will need to move them.
Okay. So you just one moment, if you could just hold on one moment. Okay. Why don't we hold off on the amendments for the moment?
Okay.
I understand that the version of the bill in members' packets is not the subcommittee engrossment. So just want to, if you could, let's see, we can maybe take testimony on this. We'll see how this proceeds here, but we'll see if we can get it to members in a timely fashion here. Representative Quam, did you have a...
No, Mr. Chair, the question was, We shall receive the engrossment in time for producing questions.
Yes, I will not. I won't take any abrupt action on this without making sure we have the correct version here. So, could you please describe the bill?
Sure, Mr. Chair and members. I'll do a quick summary through all of the sections,
mm-hmm.
and afterwards, hopefully, you'll have the latest engrossment. We can possibly, you know, move those amendments, and then we can start with question and answers. So,
Section one
relates to, it permits the office to prepare a ballot from the statewide voter registration system for the participants and sending all corresponding material. Sections 2, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, 11, 17, 19, 20, 23, 24, 26, 38, 39, 40, 45, 47, and 50 updates language to say maintains residence rather than resides for clarification purposes. Sections 3 and Section 4 clarifies that when a voter is registered to vote, they certify that they have maintained residence at the address they are registering to vote at for at least 20 days preceding the election. It clarifies that a Minnesota driver's license, identification card, or last four digits of a voter's Social Security number are required to register to vote unless the voter has not been issued any. Section 7 provides a deadline for when county auditors must submit postal verification cards, reports to the Office of Secretary of State, and clarifies that counties need to submit PVC numbers related to the previous state general election. Section 12 conforms language to mirror the policy regarding the voter registration public information lists and accepts absentee ballot lists for those who have asked that their information be withheld for safety reasons and requires that this is withheld while AB applications are inspected. Sections 13 and Section 14 moves deadlines for county auditors to make absentee polling place designations from subdivision 2 to subdivision 1, updates subdivision title to reflect subdivision substance. These changes are only for clarification purposes. Section 15 conforms language to mirror the policy regarding the voter registration public information list and accepts absentee ballot lists for those who have asked for their information to be withheld for several reasons and require that this is withheld while the names of voters have been submitted an absentee ballot that has not been accepted or inspected. Section 16 clarifies that if more than one voted ballot is enclosed in a ballot envelope, that it is spoiled and may not be counted. This ensures that presidential primary voters who return both presidential primary ballots with only one voted ballot do not have their voted ballot spoiled. Section 18 requires that the UOCAVA voter's name and address on the return envelopes appear in substantially the same form as on the application record provided to the election judges by the county auditor. Section 21 adds language to give cities the option to require write-in candidates for locally elected offices to file a formal request if they wish to have their write-in votes individually recorded. Also gives cities the ability to only tally write-in votes if the number is equal to or greater than the votes for a candidate listed on the ballot. Without this change, city election officials are required to take considerable time and resources to count and individually record write-in votes cast, many of which are frivolous. Example, Mickey Mouse. Requires a write-in candidate for governor or lieutenant governor file jointly with the person who seeks nomination as a candidate for the office. This also applies to those running as write-in candidates for president and vice president. Section 22 amends language to say that a city/town only needs to adopt an ordinance or resolution by the end of the year with the polling place locations if the polling locations change from the previous year. Additionally, corrects the omission of the reference to counties in referencing other elections that may have been held in township polling locations. Section 25 clarifies that write-in blanks are required for special elections. This was presumed based on reference statute, but it now specifies it. Section 27 clarifies that mail elections may include an office when an election has overlapping school and municipal jurisdictions, and one of the jurisdictions also has a question on the ballot. Section 28 requires that all polling places, regardless of the size of a city or township, must have voting hours starting at 7 a.m. for the state primary and state general elections. This eliminates any confusion and gives voters equal opportunities and time to vote, regardless of where they live, and I believe that one of the amendments will address that. Section 29 conforms the language around counting ballots at the end of the election to mirror the language for counting ballots before opening a polling location, giving election judges the same authority that they have at the beginning of the day to assume that prepackaged ballots have the correct number of ballots in them. Section 30 reduces the number of summary tapes that must be provided to the county auditor from 2 to 1. As the state no longer requires a summary tape for each polling precinct to be provided for state canvass. Here's my best, most exciting section. Sorry for adding into this. Section 31 clarifies that a person receiving the highest number of votes for the office they are seeking is the candidate to be declared duly elected by the state canvassing board. Section 32 clarifies that the filing period for requesting a recount begins after the close of the canvass for that election. Section 33 clarifies the order of offices in the event that there is a special election held on the date of a primary election, requiring that the vacant office be filled by a special election must be listed with other offices of the type, but under any office of the type for which the candidate will be elected for a full term. Example, Senator Klobuchar and Senator Smith. Section 34 clarifies the order of offices in the event that there's a special election held on the date of a general election, requiring the vacant office being filled by a special election must be listed with other offices of that type, but under any office of the type for which a candidate will be elected for a full term. Again, the example is Senator Klobuchar and Senator Smith. Section 35 clarifies that the notice of contest for a special primary must be filled within 2 days after the canvass is completed. This is consistent with the notice period for a contest in a special election. Section 36 requires that a candidate filing for the office of United States Senator to fill a vacancy at a special election when both offices of the United States Senator are required to be placed on the same ballot must specify on the affidavit of candidacy the expiration date of the term of office from which the candidate is seeking. Section 37 specifies where the expiration date of the term of office the term of each office shall be printed when the names of the candidates for both offices of United States Senate are required to be placed on the same ballot. Sections 41 and sections 42 require escalation of post-election review if the results of the electronic voting system differ by more than 0.25% from the manual count of the office's review. Section 43 clarifies the ballot title used in election when both municipal or school district offices or questions appear on the ballot, and that this title is not just limited to elections in odd-numbered years. Section 45 clarifies correct terminology when referring to the presidential primary example ballot. Section 46 clarifies times that the campaign insignia is prohibited at the polling place during voting hours. Section 48 clarifies that those elected at a special election shall take and subscribe the oath required by law within 10 days after receiving a certificate or notice of election or appointment. Section 49 clarifies that all provisions of the Minnesota election law are applicable to special elections as far as practical. And Section 51 repeals language authorizing towns with less than 500 inhabitants in unorganized territories to pick a later time for voting to begin in a state primary, special, or general election. And I just want to let you know, Mr. Chair and members, that I did that all without any water.
Nicely done, Representative Dean. Ms. Bonowitz, did you want to speak to anything? Another thing we can do here is just have Representative Dean describe the amendments. I believe there's at least one question about one of the amendments, but I do want to make sure we have the proper version of the bill before us before we take any formal action. So, I don't know. Ms. Bonowitz, did you want to speak to the bill at all, or were you just going to hear for questions? If you could please say your name and answer my question.
Yeah. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sam Bonowitz. I'm with the Office of the Secretary of State. I am here with Representative Dean to answer any questions and also to help with these amendments. So,
okay, thank you, Ms. Bonowitz. Representative Dean, would you care to just explain maybe start with the A2 amendment, what it does, and then I'll see if there are any questions to that. Then you can sort of describe the A3, and I'll see if there's any questions related to that.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members. A2 addresses the issue of the starting times that polls should be open, and I know that there were some townships and other groups that have a little bit concern about the starting time being 7 a.m. And the Secretary of State's office have worked with them, and we believe that A2 actually resolves that issue so that to the satisfaction of the towns as well as to the satisfaction of the Secretary of State's office. So I'll let Ms. Bonowitz speak to that directly if you'd like, and then we can hopefully have the latest engrossment in front of us. If not, we will try to talk about the A3 amendment.
Sure, sounds good. Ms. Bonowitz.
Chair, members of the committee, the A2 amendment, like Representative Dean said, is in response to testimony received during the last hearing in the elections subcommittee. It required townships to open at 7 a.m. Right now they have the authority to open as late as 10 a.m. We removed that. Instead, now that statutory language allowing them to open up as late as 10 a.m. remains, but instead now we're asking that any township that decides to open a little bit later than 7 a.m. notify our office, just so we are able to also notify voters and let voters know when they call us and say, hey, I'm at the polling place and it's not open. We're able to know if that's a polling place that's just opening a little later.
Sure. Thank you. Were there any questions to the A2 amendment? Okay, the correct engrossment is being handed out. While that's being done, maybe you could speak to the A3 amendment as well.
Mr. Chair, I will actually ask sure. Ms. Bonowitz to address the A3 amendment.
Sure. Ms. Bonowitz, if you could please describe the A3 amendment.
Chair, members of the committee, this is in response to the last hearing as well in the election subcommittee. There were some questions about the language and grammar in this section. This does not change the policy. It's just for clarifying purposes only, kind of rearranging some words, adding some commas, removing some commas.
Thank you, Ms. Bonowitz. Representative Quam, was your question to the A3 amendment?
Main bill.
Okay. Sure. I understand we have to first make a motion to adopt the committee report, to adopt this engrossment as the committee report. Is that the correct, Mr. Gehring? Is that the correct motion to make? I did actually move the bill to Ways and Means as an initial matter, right? I assume that would be the first step.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, so then the procedure here, since you don't have an actual committee report in the packet, would be to adopt the document you have now in front of you, this SCEH 1487-1, as the committee report from the Subcommittee on Elections. And once you do that, then you get this document in front of you to amend.
Okay.
With A2 and A3.
So I will move the SCEH 1487-1 report as the committee report. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay, motion. Yes, I think I did that right. Okay, sorry, this is a little different. So then, we can take amendments. Okay. So Representative Dean described the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion, member discussion to the A2 amendment? Okay, I will move the A2 amendment. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion carries, the A2 amendment is adopted. And then I will move the A3 amendment, which Representative Dean also described. Is there any discussion to that one? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the A3 amendment is adopted. Chair Dean, the bill is in the shape you would like. Now, Representative Qualm, is this a good time for your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it is that I've got two queries, and mainly for clarification. Section 46, soliciting near polling places. I am very familiar with arriving a half hour, 45 minutes early, and there already being a line outside the door at polling locations. Therefore, people would be outside the facility before actual voting would take place. And if this 46 goes in effect, there's no prohibition to campaigning near the polling place, which would be among the voters in line waiting to vote.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Qualm. And just for the benefit of the testifiers, it's Section 46 in the old engrossment, but Section 49 in the new engrossment relating to soliciting near polling places. Would one of you have a response?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Bonowitz address it.
Chair, members of the committee, the intention of this was to allow, there are oftentimes candidate forums held at county or city halls, and there was concerns from outside groups like the League of Women Voters, for example. You know, if they have a candidate forum in an evening when early voting is happening or when absentee voting is happening, are they allowed to have campaign items there? And so the intent was to allow them to have candidate forums and the like at the county halls or county buildings and city halls during the evening hours when voting isn't occurring. That was the intent of this.
Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I suggest the slight adding of language, if it was the day of the actual election instead of the hours of the election. So I understand hours of voting during the month and a half before, but the actual day of the election, I'd feel much more comfortable if that was used instead of the day of the election. It's only the hours the poll is technically open, because there have been occasions of where we ran out of ballots, so things are delayed. And there are also occasions of where there's a large line out the building, and they're already in line before, you know, at the time that polls would close, and that, you know, practice has been to allow the people in line to vote, but now they could be exposed to campaigning.
Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that we can probably work on some language to make sure that that's applying to Election Day. You bring up an interesting issue, though, of long, long lines, is when those lines get over 100 feet away from the door of the polling place. There's nothing in our provision that stops a candidate from trying to persuade voters to vote for them once they fall outside that 100 foot circle from polling place. I mean, I'm hoping candidates aren't doing that. I hope they're, you know, they're on the phones or trying to be most effective than going to a polling location. But that is an interesting thing that you bring up, Representative Qualm.
Yeah. Representative Qualm?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have another question. I noticed the prevalence through multiple parts of the bill of changing resides to maintain Yeah, maintained residence. I'd like to better understand that so that if somebody has a lease for an apartment, is paid for the apartment, but hasn't moved into it, is that a maintained residence? I'm trying to, further clarification on definition.
Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I'll actually let Ms. Benowitz speak to that. There was lots of discussion about, the language and how we're using it, and I think that this adds some clarity, hopefully, and I'll let her address that.
Ms. Benowitz.
Chair, members of the committee, these sections that update language to say maintains residence or maintained residence, rather than resides, is for clarity purposes. Maintaining residence is kind of defined in statute already, but residing is not. And so this really comes into play with voting and with election issues when a student may reside at school, but they maintain their residence at home. And this is just for clarity purposes for them and for the other dozen places that this is. Just to make sure that we're consistent in the language that we're using that's already defined in statute.
Representative Quam?
Thank you. It doesn't, quite explain the whole thing. Does having a P.O. box at a P.O. box store qualify as maintained residence?
Ms. Bonowitz?
I don't believe so. There's a number of items that you kind of have to check those boxes to determine if you maintain residence somewhere. A P.O. box would not be.
Actually, Mr. Chair, this would be a good question for our nonpartisan staff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, so there's in section 200.031 of statute is a list of factors that are used to determine where a person resides, and it doesn't allow for someone to use a P.O. box or other type of space like that to claim residence at that location.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I'm confused because in the house district around the University of Minnesota campus, the Minneapolis area, there was actually action by a former member that actually was a member of the House for many decades. And there was, I believe it was around 400 voters utilized a P.O. box store as their address of residence, and it was determined that sufficed to being a residence for, voting. And I'm not sure if it was a district court or if the Secretary of State's office was involved, so that when we're changing over to the, new information, I just like to have clarity because our former member, she had that first parking spot, out at the SOB, brought that up. And so clarification is this change makes it so that people that are using a P.O. box at a P.O. box store, no longer qualify as maintained residence in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean, if we could, I realize in the excitement about the engrossment, there is a person signed up to testify to, so if you could answer this question quickly, but I would like to at least.
I would just say.
And we may have somebody who's able to answer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam. The member that you're speaking to was in office long before I got here, so I don't want to speak directly to that. I think that many students do maintain P.O. boxes, but they also maintain a permanent residence, some of them in their dorms or other locations. So I think that that's where the statute comes in, and if you would come up, Ms. Struthers, to maybe speak to this issue.
Mr. Chair, as she approaches, these were not, the 400-some were not primarily students.
Okay. So, well, Based on what Mr. Gehring said, it sounds like at least currently the statute would exclude the possibility of just a P.O. box being used to determine residency. I mean, we can try to find out more information and certainly get it back to you. But Ms. Struther, if you could just identify yourself and answer the question if you have, if you're able to shed some light on it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Struther with the Secretary of State's office. That issue you're talking about, if we're thinking of the same issue, it was actually determined a P.O. box cannot be an individual's residence. I can follow up with you after about how Hennepin County and the City of Minneapolis handled those registrations. Some of them were determined to be in error. Some of them were automatically updated within a change of address. And this is, it cannot be used as a place of residence, and you cannot use a P.O. box to register as your address. I think part of the confusion in that instance, it was technically a mail service center where the address looked not, it didn't say P.O. box 1234. It said a street address, number 1234, and it appeared like an apartment building, but that is still not allowed to be used as your place of residence. You can use it as your mailing address, but it can't be where you register to vote unless you meet one of the criteria in the definition. But I can follow up afterwards with the information we have about how that was dealt with by the county.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the clarification, and I eagerly await that information in. Hopefully it'll make clear so that we don't have, you know, erroneous registrations in future elections.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I have on the list a Ruth Simpson from the Minnesota Association of Townships. I apologize for the delay. Thank you for your patience here. I will have to ask you to be brief, though, considering we're very close to the time we need to be out of this room.
Thank you, Chair, for allowing me to testify, and I will try to keep this very brief. I did bring a handout, so I'll let you
Emily there.
Hand that out so I don't have to repeat everything.
Sure.
I had previously testified, and I think I will agree we've kind of taken care of our concern about moving the time for the election so that towns can still vote at 10 a.m. or choose to vote at 10 a.m. So I thank the Secretary of State's office for that change. My issue deals with Section 22, which is the requirement to designate a polling place. And the issue came about last year because one of our townships realized later on that they could not vote in their own township because they had a combined polling place, and it got changed because two of the people that they did their combined polling with decided to go to the mail ballot. And so when they talked to the auditor's office after a lot of different confusion, the auditor told them they couldn't vote anywhere else than the city of Fountain, which is they were Pilot Mound. And so the issue was, why couldn't they vote in their own polling place in their own township? And so I went and we looked at the statute, and I think there's a lot of confusion I think in the statute between Section 1 and Section 3. Section 1 talks about designating a polling place every year by December 31st, but Section 3 says that once a designation is made, it stays in effect until it changes, which is entirely different. And then finally, it allows you to make some changes, Section 3, up to 90 days before an election, whereas at least the county auditor says if you didn't make the designation, you know, by December 31st, you couldn't make a change. And so I see there's conflict in the statute. It doesn't list anything about combined polling places, which you don't have to make that decision till May 1st. Mail ballot is the same. That happens in May. And then finally, there's nothing in the statute that says who enforces it. There's no requirement that your resolution be sent to the county auditor's office. So I see some issues in there about, you know, the change that was made. We're not sure why it needs to be designated, you know, every year. Some places don't vote every year. So that's what I wanted to bring to your attention.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this bill? Not seeing any. Any additional member discussion? Okay. I'm not seeing any, so thank you again, Ms. Simpson. Chair Dean, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I'd ask for your support.
Okay. Thank you. So I will renew my motion that House File 1487, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Your bill is on its way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Kind of amazed, but we made it through the whole planned session. So I don't really have anything else on the agenda. I don't see any member discussion, so we are adjourned.